Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Mike Malott, Jack Spencer, John Rurink, and a little later, James Holman. He is the Assistant Director of Fiscal Policy for the Mackinac Center. And guys, we know it's spring because we can hear the mower in the background. And if it's not our own mower, it's the Supreme Court or it's that big property over there that was supposed to be townhouses 15 years ago, but it's still a vacant MDOT lot.
And at one point, it was possibly going to be a governor's residence.
That was a long time ago. That would be pretty cool, though, if they brought that back.
Well, yeah, we could watch the governor come and go from our offices. That'd be really good.
There would be more reasons to put additional security cameras on the top of the building.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you'd run into problems with the people who now currently use it to walk their dogs, and then they would have to go someplace else.
They would have to take their dog doo-doo somewhere else.
Yep.
Presumably. Okay.
That's what the front of the Supreme Court's for.
All right, well, we've got a couple subjects we want to talk about. Jeffrey Figer going on off the record over the weekend saying that he's considering running for governor. He was approached to come on the program. And the question I want to ask, has there ever been an opportunity when Jeffrey Figer has been invited to talk about running for office that he's said no to such offer? It seems like he's always kind of considering
this. Well, you know, Jeffrey Figer's favorite subject is Jeffrey Figer. The fact that he went on off the record after being asked to come on off the record is not a surprise. The real question is, this is what I think you outlined in your piece, the fifth time?
Sixth time.
Sixth time since he lost the gubernatorial race in 1998 to John Engler. That he has threatened to run for public office. Whether he will do that or not, I'm not going to put any money on it.
Well, and I'm not going to put any money on it either, because you just never know with Figer. There's an unpredictability there that he could wake up one morning and say, yeah, I want to go ahead and actually do something like that. Jack, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, as you say, with Jeffrey Figer, you always have the possibility for the unexpected, even though he's, you know, as you say, it's the sixth time, and I think the whole Trump thing and all of 2016 kind of adds a veracity to it, the possibility of, okay, is it time again for an outsider? I hate to use the term, is it Jeffrey Figer time again? But this is kind of the added element, of course, and you go, as I did, it was like, oh yeah, Figer. Oh yeah, after Trump? So I think that kind of adds a lot more to the speculation.
The interesting thing when you start to think about if he does get in this race, the Democrats in the state should probably be very nervous because he could very much disrupt their primary enough and win and face the exact same result that he faced in 1998, which was facing a unified Republican Party, and he just doesn't have the muster to win a general.
Well, but he would appeal, it would seem like, to Macomb County, and the same voters who voted for Trump, maybe they could be swayed by a Jeffrey Figer, Mike.
But regardless of whether or not he runs, this is all publicity for his law firm. So, you know, as we're talking about it, we're giving him the publicity he's looking for.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
It's free advertising.
Well, and I just can't help but think that this is leverage for something else. Somewhere down the line, whether it's his $100 million lawsuit he's got against McLaren and various former employees of the Department of Environmental Quality or something else, it seems like he's mastered the ability to use this platform for something else. And I'm thinking back in 2005 when he said he was running for attorney general, when he was being investigated for campaign finance violations, he was able to say, oh, wait a minute, this is a political attack now, because now I'm an attorney general candidate. So now the attorney general is coming after me to make me all of a sudden Jeffrey Figer the victim. I mean, that's just an example of how he's able to use this as political leverage down the line for something, whether it's this lawsuit or who knows, whatever else. The most serious candidate right now, as far as another potential Democratic candidate, and obviously there's a void because there's a whole bunch of people out there who's ready to support Dan Kildee. Now that he's out, they're looking for something. And maybe it ends up being some of the candidates in the field, but maybe they're able to talk somebody else in. Just from what I was able to gather this past week, it seems like the chances are better that no one else gets in of a high profile, but I wanted to get your guys' opinion on this, Mike.
You've got a field out there with a number of good candidates. I think Gretchen Whitmer is a pretty solid candidate. I think gives her a boost to go ahead.
Well, I hate to put the onus on Gretchen Whitmer, but to me, if nobody else gets in, this is hers to lose.
You know, talked about the possibility there. I mean, Mark Bernstein's a possibility. Someone else could get in the field yet, but I mean, clearly the Gretchen is, I think, still the strongest frontrunner.
All right, let's move on to a different subject here. Mike Rogers, over the weekend, gets the endorsement of Federal Bureau of Investigations, basically their labor union.
Yeah, basically they're organized.
They had a labor
they're organized agents, and it's an important endorsement in a lot of ways. If you think about it, you remember one of the reasons, and I say one tongue-in-cheek, the excuses that Trump gave for firing Comey was the bad morale among FBI staff and agents. And obviously, if the agents of the FBI are given Mike Rogers a green light, that might be a good reason to push up his name among those considered. Because then he can say, look, as I said, the morale was low, and now I'm appointing this guy. This was the choice of the agents, and there you go.
Now, Mike, you were able to cover Mike Rogers as the editor of the Livingston County paper and the news editor at the time. And there was a little scuttle at the time when he decided he was not going to run for Congress again in 2014, that maybe there were some skeletons in the closet. You remember this conversation?
Yeah. It was a question about whether or not his wife's involvement with security contracts, because she's her own security person. She's her own power broker within Washington, behind the scenes, of course, not nearly as visible as Mike. But there's a question as to whether or not there was a conflict of interest, and we looked into that as deeply as we could, and quite frankly, we couldn't find a conflict. They use a blind bidding procedure that protects against that sort of a thing, and everyone that we talked to was very confident that there was no conflict.
So what's your thoughts on Mike Rogers being the next FBI agent?
I think he's a really solid pick. He's a former FBI agent himself. He was head of House Intelligence for the longest time, and he knows the security systems very well. I think he'd do a good job at it, actually.
Would he be one of these political picks that the Democrats are urging Trump not to make?
His problem, from my perspective, would be that in Congress, there are some people who are very unhappy with his handling of a Benghazi inquiry, a report, et cetera. And my interpretation of that is that the investigation did not end up turning up all kinds of as many nasty things about Hillary Clinton and Obama as what some people in Congress was hoping it would.
Well, maybe that would help him with Democrats then, because he didn't make it into what could have been an explosive political issue.
It might be, but my question on it would be, okay, if you're Trump, to what extent would you be concerned about, you know, who's he trying to please? Who isn't he trying to please? Is he trying to please anybody other than himself? And, you know, would the congressional complaints and, you know, behind closed doors activity against Rogers, how would that play with Trump's choice?
Well, it seems to me that of all the people who are being talked, it seems like that there are FBI bureaucrats and then there's Mike Rogers kind of floating out there. He was a supporter of Donald Trump's, too, if I'm not mistaken.
He was a supporter of Donald Trump. He was actually on the transition team for a brief period, but I think he was swept out at the same time that Chris Christie was removed as the chairman of the transition team. But, yeah, he was. He's and the other thing is, you know, you can't really say he's a current sitting politician, which is, I think, what the Democrats were trying to argue against during the Sunday round of shows. I mean, he's been out of office now for a while, so I don't think you can classify him as a current politician. So.
Right. No, I mean, he's got his own show and he's got his own group that he's kind of the face of right now on national security issues. So his toes are still dipped into the issues very much. Well, it's another Michigan tie, and it would be a heck of a coup for Michigan. We're doing pretty good, I think, on the appointments with Ronald Romney McDaniel and Betsy DeVos. If we can get this one, too. I got to say that Michigan's doing pretty well as far as representation. And the Department of Human Services director, who was in town with Snyder, originally from Michigan as well, went to Lansing and has a background, went to University of Michigan. So I think we're doing pretty good as far as the Trump appointees, if Rogers is able to get in. Joining us now for the podcast is James Holman. He's the Assistant Director of Fiscal Policy for the Mackinac Center of Public Policy. Thanks for joining us, James.
Thanks for having me on.
Making the trip down from Midland, everything went well, I imagine. How long you been with the Mackinac Center?
I've been with Mackinac Center since 2002.
So, 15 years. And tell me your interest in this issue on teacher retirement.
An actuary reached out to us around 2007 and said, hey, this is a really big issue. We're promising a lot of benefits, and we're not setting aside the money to pay for it. So we've been working on this issue since then. He brought me up to speed on pension funding mechanics, and I've been researching and writing about this subject since 2011.
Now, when you mention pensions and you talk about actuaries, so I think the general public's eyes would start to glaze over. Why should they care about teacher pensions?
Well, it's the biggest fiscal policy issue facing the state. We have inadvertently or accidentally made school employees the state's largest creditors. We've got $29 billion that is owed to them. These are contractual rights. People are depending on this. And it's both fair and appropriate that we need to make sure that we pay for what we have promised.
Now, give our listeners a little lay of the land here, because we have this old teacher pension system, and then Snyder came into office and created a hybrid system, correct?
Well, it's a hybrid system, but it's a defined benefit system. It's both a defined benefit and a small defined contribution plan on top of that. And at least as far as funding-wise, the only benefit that you get is that you're assuming it's going to grow at 7% instead of 7.5%. It doesn't provide a whole lot of protections to taxpayers.
Okay, but just as I understand it then, we had this old system. Now, did the hybrid allow people to join into this old pension system, or is this a completely new pension system that was created?
It's operated through the Office of Retirement Services. The money is kind of mixed within it. It's still the same defined benefit pension plan, and it really hasn't limited the ability to continue to rack up debt in this plan, and that's the main concern that I have about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's also not necessarily a great one for teachers. It takes 10 years to vest. And over half of teachers aren't going to vest in this plan. And it also requires high employee contributions, which means that there's a lot more coming out of teachers' paychecks to pay for it. But it doesn't. Unless you get rid of your ability to rack up these unfunded liabilities, it doesn't provide better solvency or better protections that the money is going to be there when they retire.
See, the argument for these defined pension or these defined benefit programs is that you have to have people continuing to contribute into them, right? Into perpetuity, right? And so that is your benefits today. I'm paying into the pension system today, so the person who used to be in it is getting the benefits. So but when you shut that off, then you close it off, right? There's no money.
That is exactly how a pay-as-you-go pension system like Social Security works, but that's not how a pre-funded pension system works. The way that our system works, or is supposed to work, is that an employee works for a year, they earn a little bit of pension, and their employer sets money into the pension system to pay for that benefit so that it's there when it retires. It ensures that the people that are paying for the service pay for that service when they're working, and it stops it from being a long-term liability. So we don't kick the cost for current service to future taxpayers.
Okay.
Unfortunately, if you use bad assumptions or if you don't put those dollars in, it does get passed along. And in fact, this has been a long-term problem in the state of Michigan. This school retirement system has been fully funded just once in the past 43 years.
But it seems like you can keep it going while also kicking more money into it. I mean, what's wrong? Why do you have to close it in order to solve it?
So you don't. There are two ways to keep this problem from being kicked onto the cost of future taxpayers. One is use better funding assumptions. So, for instance, it wasn't until just about this year that the state was even paying the interest on the debt in this system. If you change that, then you can start to catch up more. It requires more taxpayer dollars. But yeah, if you use more conservative funding assumptions, you won't be kicking the cost to the future. Now, that's going to increase the stated cost of the plan, but it's really, considering that this has been underfunded for so long, it just stops you from, that's what the pensions cost right now. We just have been ignoring the true cost of these pensions.
But the way this plays out, sort of in the political world, is people hear this, they say, of course we ought to close this, of course we ought to get rid of this, it's terrible, this debt, and then they call their lawmaker, and their lawmaker says, yeah, it's a good idea, but it costs too much.
Yeah.
And that's how it actually plays, and then after that, the people's heads spin because it gets complicated.
So that's been the traditional case of saying, we would like to close this. We don't want to kick these costs to the future, because that's the second way, is that you change the plan so that you don't have to make a whole bunch of assumptions and there aren't these political incentives to underfund the system. And they say, well, if you do that, it's going to trigger all these transition costs. Well, actually, no. I mean, I looked in this in a study in 2012, and there's nothing forcing you to do that. There are some industry guidelines that that suggest you might want to do this if you close your retirement system, but nothing's forcing you to. The Governmental Accounting Standards Board doesn't have an army, and we're already not abiding by a lot of pension funding best practices as it exists, including Article 9, Section 24 of the state constitution, which says you really are supposed to pay for these benefits as they are earned.
So when Mitch Bean says that if you close the system off, that means it's, what, $680 million liability next year, $1 billion after that, $1 billion after that. You're saying actually what you can do is you can kind of smooth it out and push it off down the road if you want. You don't you don't have to pay it.
So keep in mind, I mean, this system needs more money in it. It's $29.1 billion underfunded. That generates annual interest that costs more than the Department of Corrections. But this policy change of offering new employees defined contribution retirement systems does not trigger any change to how to the existing liabilities that are in the system. Now, if you want to put more money in it, that's great. If you want to change your amortization plan, that's great. It's probably worth looking at. But nothing's forcing you to do that. Some people might want to do these things in concert, but that's a policy option that's fully within the control of the legislature and the governor.
Isn't not paying the startup or transition costs, however you want to call it, to switching to a 401k right away, is that not also kicking the can down the road?
It would be exactly as prudent as our current plan. So if you owe retirees a whole bunch of money, and we've got a plan to pay for that. And if you change what you're offering new employees, you can keep that plan if you want it. The other point to show that these transition costs are entirely optional, though, is just say, okay, if you don't pay them, what happens? If you don't pay your vendors, they say, no, you really have to pay this. They charge you penalties. And then if worse comes to it, they'll take you to court. Nothing like that would happen with these transition costs.
Is there any sense that that you've won over the governor a little more, or that he's bending a little more because he's a CPA and, of course, he went with a hybrid instead? Is there any sense at all that, well, maybe there's some reconsideration on this?
I really am not certain. It's just that these are important issues. Our policymakers need to work on them. But if we don't win over the governor on this issue, or if these transition costs really must be paid and are prohibitive, this issue doesn't go away. I mean, it's going to take decades before we finally catch up to what we owe school employees in the system.
This may be a bit of an aside, but how much does Michigan's stagnant or at least lackluster population growth play into the assumptions you're working with here?
So the state currently assumes that payroll within the school employee retirement system is going to grow at 3.5%. So it doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be more teachers in the system, but overall the payroll is going to grow 3.5%. We haven't been able to get that. It's been falling. With economic growth, the school pension system becomes smaller. It's ultimately taxpayers that are going to be there, and property taxes, sales taxes, lottery money, and everything else that we use to pay schools. That's the ultimate base that's going to pay off these unfunded liabilities. And if we can grow that base, this is a much easier problem. But I don't think we are not assuming that the pension funding assumptions do not require estimates about the state population.
One of the other issues that the governor and the legislature is working on right now is the post-retiree health care benefits for city workers, municipal workers, huge unfunded liability there for local schools. What's your advice on how the governor and the legislature can handle this?
The deal that we have right now for pay-as-you-go retiree health care is crazy. It is. We're going to offer employees this benefit, but we reserve the right to cut it at any time, and we're not going to set any money aside to pay for it. Now, the governor has been really good on this issue. We're head and shoulders above most other places. We surveyed a number of the major cities in Michigan. We found only two of them offered that same type of coverage that a lot of our other governments have been offering. And we're starting to pre-fund any of the liabilities that remain. Now, The state can still cut more, but we've closed out OPEB for the school retirement system. That's around half of all government employees in Michigan. We did that for the state employee system. That's another, you know, 50,000 or so employees. So we're well on our way to digging ourselves out of this hole while still providing retiree health insurance coverage to legacy members, and also providing defined contribution retiree health care coverage to new employees.
So maybe local governments are going to have to take a page and end these benefits going forward.
So they might consider that. That is, and there's a good case that you can make for that, considering that government is the only place where these things exist. We haven't set money aside to do that, but I don't know that there's going to be the political will necessary to do that. If you're talking about kicking grandma off her health insurance, I think that's a challenging proposal to make for legislators.
Last question here before I let you go, James, is now do you think the best time that the state's had in a long time to end the teacher's pension plan, the MIPSRs, close the MIPSRs program?
Well, I think 1997, the 1 year where the plan was fully funded, would have probably been a better time. And we might have helped to prevent a lot of these unfunded liabilities from existing. But this plan, we need to address it. We need to stop promising benefits now and paying for them later. And you can do that by changing your assumptions. And the governor is doing that. We dropped our payroll assumption to 7.5% this year. Or offer a plan where you don't need to make these contributions. And you need to do that right now, I think. But if you don't do that right now, this problem's going to exist tomorrow. And regardless of what lawmakers do, you need to catch up on those unfunded liabilities. And that's going to take years.
I got one more question here, and I don't know if you know the answer to this or not, but you may happen to, in passing, make a statement there I want to double check on. Is government the only place that does this?
There are still some private sector plans that are out there. They've kind of converted more towards a cash balance system, which is functions a little bit differently from what the state does. But it's rare. The driver for this reform should not be private sector jealousy or envy. It should be preventing us from accidentally making teachers the largest creditors to the state of Michigan. There have been a lot of people that have argued that pensions are inherently better. Like annuitized retirement income is really good, and we should do what we can to protect that. And I think if you think that, you also have a moral imperative that your benefits that you're offering today don't become liabilities for future taxpayers. And they haven't done that. There are some places where there are employee groups that are strong advocates for pension funding, and I just haven't seen that here in Michigan.
One of the questions I want to ask you is, obviously, you've spoken to the impact on the state's fiscal health of not doing anything. Have you looked at the viability of 401k-based retirements and how they're doing, and what the generation that's had them and that is approaching retirement, how they're going to be situated vis-a-vis these pensioners?
Well, I mean, this is the first generation that are facing those questions. And the basic point is that they're investing in the same things that the pension system is investing in. The allocations are a little different. The state's been very risky. I think it's got over 10% private equities, a bunch of real estate deals that you probably aren't going to see in a typical 401k plan. It's a huge responsibility to save for your own retirement. Employers in the private sector have been willing to offer defined contribution plans. They've been unwilling to offer defined benefit plans. I think partially is because it requires a lot of funding at a time when you're going to be stressed for assets. I think it's going to be an important question going forward. But I think if you're saving 10 to 15% of your salary in a defined contribution plan, if you're using a diversified mutual fund, I have index funds for my own personal plan, I think you're going to be fine.
You could argue that there is a security knowing that you're going to have money under a pension plan, whereas under your own personal 401k, well, geez, if the economy tanks, then you're kind of without a life jacket there.
And if you think that that is the really important to do, you really need to be a pension funding advocate. You need to say the system that we have that kicks the cost to future taxpayers is dangerous to teachers, it's dangerous to taxpayers, and we've continually failed to set aside enough money to pay for it. Because if having that annuitized retirement income is the most important thing that you can offer employees, then you need to address the inherent problems that the state is faced with it.
And so you're not against pensions in general. You just got to pay for them.
Yeah. There are terrible political incentives to properly fund a pension system. It's one reason why Michigan's not the only state that's dealing with this problem. I've yet to see a campaign ad that that says, vote for me, I will ensure that the pension system is properly funded.
Very good. James Holman, he's the Assistant Director of Fiscal Policy for the Mackinac Center of Public Policy up in Midland. Thanks for making the drive down. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to James Holman for making the drive down from Midland. You know what he told us is that he'll drive anywhere. If anybody's interested in listening to MIPSers, Battle Creek, Albion, 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, that's pretty
some time. That's a long drive.
That's a long drive. That's some pretty diehard.
You can only get me up that early if I'm going fishing.
Yeah, well, then there's a reason, right? Because that's what time the fish are biting.
That's right, yeah.
Heck of a drive, though, to make that early morning. Oh, almost on cue, the podcast is ending. You know when the podcast is ending?
When the mower stops.
When the mower stops, of course. So thank you for the lawnmower for ending the mowing as soon as we're done with the podcast. We could always retape this too, Jack.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Any bets on if we sat back and said, okay, let's do this again, that suddenly that noise pops up?
Oh, you know what? You're probably exactly right. Well, we could try that and see what happens, but I think one take is probably good enough. Well, until next week, I'm Kyle Nguyen. Take care.